All right, welcome back to the Make or Break Show. This week we're hanging out with Lars Christensen from Autodesk Fusion 360. This is a pretty fun interview with Lars. I think you guys are really going to enjoy it. But before we get into the show, as always, here at the very top, I want to thank all the awesome and wonderful supporters over on Patreon. The show is brought to you by those folks, and it would not be possible without you. Thank you so much if you support. I know we are on a pause over the summer, but appreciate you sticking around. And if you guys would like to support the show, you can head over to Make or Break Shop. .com/Patreon to help get these episodes out on an ongoing basis. And I've been working on some stuff behind the scenes, so I can actually be streaming these live a little bit different. So I actually have some new tech that I'm playing around with. And be sure and watch my YouTube channel, so the Make or Break Shop, and you should see some live interviews popping up. We've got some really fun ones coming up actually very soon. And I encourage you guys to check out. So you can come in, join us live, or you can get your questions in for our upcoming guests. But let's actually talk about our guests. So this week we are chatting with Lars. And if you guys don't know Lars, then you probably have never tried to learn the 3D modeling program Fusion 360 before, or you've never looked for it on YouTube. Because if you have, then you know that Lars is probably the top result that you're going to find. He has been in this the 3D modeling Fusion 360 community for a really long time. He's been putting out great free content. I learned a lot on how to do Fusion because of him, and he is just a great guy. And he actually is now officially working for the Fusion 360 team on the community side. He kind of leads that effort, and we get into his new role, all the things that he's doing with them, as well as he has a really deep background on the CNC side. He worked in some pro shops back in the day, so we get into what it looks like to run those, as well as to learn new programs, and what it looks like to be a content creator online, even though he's doing it a little bit different than the rest of us. And then also right at the top, I want to mention that so Fusion had a few changes about a month ago that caused quite a stir. They were removing some things from the free plan, and Lars actually put out a great video on what those really were and how they impact you if you are using Fusion, especially if you're doing like 3D modeling for furniture or for 3D printing. And I think he does a really great job with that. But know that we actually recorded this before all those changes happened. So I actually asked him a question that kind of led into that, but we didn't get into it because none of the changes had happened. And if you guys are interested in kind of my take, I have a full write-up, and kind of the long version of it is I don't think it's a super big deal. For most of us, the changes really are affecting people that are wanting to do Fusion 360 in a manufacturing, so it's helping you save time. A lot of the changes that they were moving to their paid plan. So I still think Fusion is the best option if you guys want to do free stuff on the 3D modeling side of things. Speaking of which, I have a course, and so I might be biased, but there's furniture design in Fusion 360. If you guys are interested in that, I'll talk more about that a little bit later, but you can check it out in the show notes. But without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Lars. All right, guys, welcome back to the Make or Break Show. We're hanging out with Lars Christensen today, calling in from New York. You are the Fusion 360 guru professionally, as well as I feel like on YouTube, people may know you more from that. But thank you so much for jumping on and chatting. Excited to get into all things Fusion and CNC and everything with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me on the show, Brandon.
Yeah, nice to be excited to have you on. So I would love to get into your background a little bit, and also to give you a little bit of context. A lot of people listening to the show aren't going to be coming from maybe the professional machinist side of things, but more of the DIY maker. A lot of people might have an Venable CNC or kind of the desktop style stuff. If you start talking Haas and all that, it's great, but people may not have as much experience with that, but I know you do, so I would love to get into all that. But to kind of start out, I know you're definitely not from the States, and so you're from Denmark, but how did you get into the world of just making in general? Was that something you were into just as a kid growing up?
Not really, no.
Okay.
I don't think so. Yeah, so I'm originally from Denmark, about 25 kilometers south of Copenhagen. If anybody was wondering where the heck in Denmark. Grew up in suburban, normal kind of life. And when I was 13, I needed a new pair of sneakers, and my mom was very frugal. So it was the cheapest ones you can get at Walmart or somewhere else. And I wanted some brand or something. So she told me that, well, if you need to get those, you need to earn some money. So, I had this whole plan about that I was going to deliver flowers. So I went down to the local flower shop, and they were like, nah, we don't need anybody. So I started walking around trying to find somewhere to earn some money. And so I started in, that was an industrial area right near where I lived. So I just literally, I was 13 years old and I was walking door to door, just walking in and being like, you need somebody to cut the lawn, sweep the floor. And one of the places I walked in was a tool and die shop. But I had no idea anything about what that was. But the guy there was like, yeah, come and sweep the floor and empty the garbage cans and do that kind of stuff. So so that was actually my entry as 13-year-old into kind of that life. And started to see, you know, this thing that you could take a piece of steel and then you could actually turn it into something functional. I thought that was kind of interesting. So that was when I kind of got the taste that I wanted to do that kind of work.
Yeah. Was there a point, so you mentioned you got the taste, but like, did you know this could be a career path for me at that point? Or was it still just a job just to buy some sneakers?
Yeah, no. So when I started working there, I mean, it was definitely to get sneakers at first, but then when I started working there, these journeymans was in this shop. It was a small tool and die shop. They'd been there for many years and they were kind of like some cool guys who were really kind and kind of looked a little bit after me and, you know, made sure that I did my homework in school, things like that. And I think I started looking up to them and just seeing what they could do in steel was just fascinating to me, right? Like, it's like art, but at the same time, you're keeping these accuracies that is very tight tolerances and things like that. So that was when I decided that, yeah, I want to try to do this as a career. And then I ended up taking an apprenticeship as a mold maker, so plastic injection mold.
Okay.
So I took an apprenticeship with that. I think I started when I was like 16 and a half. And then when I was 20, I was a mold maker running those big houses and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So for people that may not know mold making, what does that actually look like? You're manufacturing dyes and stuff? Like, is that kind of the...
Yeah, so anything that gets plastic injector molded, so anything in plastic we have around our house, right?
Okay.
Like toys, whatever our kids have, or, you know, the dashboard in our car, that is all made with a plastic extruded mold. So you machine the steel, the opposite forms of the mold.
Gotcha.
The corner cavity. So you're kind of building it. It's almost like Lego pieces. You kind of build up this whole plastic mold and then you run it in an extruder. Yeah.
Cool. So how long were you with them?
So I took my apprenticeship till I was 20, and then I worked in a couple of shops in Denmark until I was 24. And that was when I made the move. I fell in love on the internet and made the move to United States, to the Rochester, New York region, where I live in this kind of the surroundings now. And then when I got over here, it was very natural to, of course, looking for something within the trade. And then I started working in a tool and die shop in Rochester, New York.
Oh, cool. Okay, so I can't go past the I fell in love on the internet and then moved across the world to the United States. How did that happen? You just met your future wife and then just started to move?
It was the late 90s, right?
Yeah.
When the internet started to really take over. And I was like a 24-year-old young kid in Denmark. I didn't have any kind of like responsibilities. And I've always thought that I wanted to try to work outside Denmark for a couple of years. I had actually gotten a job in Thailand I'd gotten a job to kind of be a shop foreman.
Okay.
Some Danish company had a place in Thailand. I'd gotten the job, but then I lost the job like 2 days after I gotten it. But they're like, yeah, this is not going to happen. So I always had like this bug that I wanted to try to work outside Denmark. And then I met this girl and, it was kind of like, yeah, why don't, let's try it. And then I moved to the United States.
So then you went and worked for more professional CNC shops once you got to the States as well?
Yeah. So when I came over here, I started working at a place that called Ritlam that don't exist anymore, but it was in Rochester, New York. It was really a blessing. It was a tool and die shop. So tool and die, so the mold making is plastic injection mold. So anything you find around your house is plastic. Tool and die is kind of like a very close cousin to it, but it's everything that is stamped out in metal.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're looking at door hinges and things like that. So I started working in a shop there because, you know, I had my trades, I had my papers. It was an easy way in. That place did convert, though, from a tool and die shop into be more of a production milling place. So we did a lot of parts for cell phone towers in the early 2000s. So we made high production parts. And that was also when I started to actually kind of getting this taste for CAD and for CAM. So we used SolidWorks and we used Mastercam back then. And that was when I kind of started to explore that. And one of the really cool things about Riddlam was that the people there, they kind of let me go wild. Mm. They kind of let me test out my crazy ideas and try new things. And they was just kind of like, let this guy do whatever he want to do and experiment. And the shop was pretty successful. We ended up being, I ended up running kind of like the shop floor, and we had like 23 operators and 3 shifts running machines.
Oh, wow.
So 24 hours parts, just spitting parts out. And that was the guy who was drawing it up in SolidWorks and then programming it in Mastercam, running the first part, do the inspection and things like that.
So was SolidWorks, was that the first kind of 3D CAD program that you learned, or did that come later?
It was the first I really dived into.
Got it.
So,
okay.
So I had used some other programs in the past, but a lot of machine shops, they kind of get maybe started with something like Mastercam, and they're doing some of that design in that too. And I had done that for a few years. And then we got to see the SolidWorks, and I really struggled in the beginning. Learning it. I think it's one of my cores why I created so many YouTube videos later on 360. Because I had such a hard time learning this stupid software. I've told the story about to other people about how I still remember a Saturday, and it must have been around 2 p.m. on a Saturday. I had punched out at noon, so I was sitting on my own dime. Trying to learn this software, SolidWorks, and with tears in my eyes, I literally got in my car and I drove to Barnes & Noble's and bought SolidWorks for Dummies.
That's funny.
Because I was so lost. I didn't get it. I was so frustrated. And I think that is what I'm carrying with me today.
Right.
Many times when I'm creating content, I remember that frustration of just, come on, man. I just want to do this one thing and I can't figure it out.
What was it about the Dummies book that got you over that hump? Was it there like fundamental things like you had to get your mind around where it started to make sense? Or was it just more of a take it all the way back to the beginning and work from there?
I don't know how much the book actually did for me, to be honest. what struck me was constraints, sketching and constraints. I didn't understand that if you draw a line, why the heck is it not just there? Why can't it move? And how do you tie everything down? Anybody of your listeners and people who's watching who have tried to use a 3D CAD system have probably tried this frustration of trying to tie down your sketches. And I just didn't get it. It frustrated the heck out of me. But at the same time, one of the things I fell over was these blocks. So there was a lot of blogs around back then, you know, people would write these long articles. And I got into that, and I read a lot of the blogs from SolidWorks users, and I started my own blog. So I started my own blog in 2008 called CADCAMstuff.com. And I started that because somebody told me that the best way to learn something is to teach it. And I thought, all right, so if I am struggling trying to learn all the ins and outs of SolidWorks, maybe if I start trying to write about it, then it will help me become better. And the blog is still up there. You can go and you can look at some of the first posts I posted. They were horrific. My English was terrible. I couldn't put a sentence together. But I don't know. It's kind of like slowly you get it.
Right? Yeah.
I think over time.
Yeah, I was looking, it looked like the last post on it was a couple of years ago. So, I mean, you did that for 10 years then? You said you started in 2008?
Not in 2008, posted a lot about SOLIDWORKS and Mastercam back then. Then in 2010, I read a book that made me question what I wanted to do with my life, about my work. So there was this book I read that talked about that, you know, some people are making $200,000 a year being investment bankers, but they absolutely hate everything about their work and they can't wait till 4 o'clock and they can go out and play golf, for example.
Right.
And the book was questioning that maybe those people will be happier. Maybe they can't be professional golfers, but maybe they will be happier making $40,000 a year working in a golf store somewhere, mm-hmm. pro golf store, something like that. It made me think a lot about what I like to do. And I was getting a little bit sick and tired of climbing in and out of CNC, these big machines, getting chips stuck in your fingers and in your shoes and the pressure of getting these machines to work. And, you know, like I said earlier, I would many times program the machines and then other people would run them and if they crashed. And I really liked the software part of it. I loved working with SOLIDWORKS and Mastercam. So I started thinking maybe there was something else I could do just doing that. And I got a job with our local SOLIDWORKS reseller as an application engineer. And then the learning really took on because now I actually had to teach SOLIDWORKS essential classes to other people. Maybe better learn it yourself.
What was it like leading? Because was it in like a class, like a in-person class format? What was it? What was it like sitting down next to people teaching them?
Yeah. So this is just like one of the things, especially, you know, any makers out there watching this, it's kind of interesting how sometimes you just never knew that there was something you were good at or you really enjoyed, right? Like early on in life, like here I am, I'm like 35 years old and I start teaching these essentials classes where people would pay. So what will happen with SOLIDWORKS resellers is you will sell a company, you know, one or two seats, a couple of seats of SOLIDWORKS, and then they pay to come in and get a week's training. Mm. So we were training them in a classroom. There's a curriculum that SOLIDWORKS had created. You had a book and all this stuff. And I never knew that I would enjoy teaching as much as I enjoy teaching. Like, who would have known? I've never done it before. You know, it reminds me a little bit of like some of the things that fascinates me a lot today is a lot of these makers who actually take what they're doing and turning it into a business. Mm-hmm. What I find fascinating. And like you think about somebody like John Saunders or John Grimsmo with knives and like these guys literally started out in their garage and they suddenly found out that there was something they really enjoyed doing and they were good at and they were able to make a living off it, right? Or even if you are just, I did a little Fusion 360 user Zoom call Monday, and there was a guy named Mike who joined who was making these cool cutting boards. He's a land surveyor by day, but you know he has a little CNC router and he cuts these cool looking cutting boards and do these crazy cool things. So that was my entry into kind of starting to teach and really just love that part of it.
Yeah. I worked when I was in college for General Electric aircraft engines, and I think we used SOLIDWORKS, but I definitely remember going to a class and like sitting. I guess you would have been the teacher, like in that class. Like I did some 3D stuff in college, but sitting through that class is like, oh, this is how that works. And it is so hard if you've never used a program, even just to understand what you're looking at. I'm like, well, I don't even get how to even start to get my head around this. But that's, yeah, the teaching side is pretty crazy. What about then the teaching? So you mentioned that people are making cool things, but do you just like the process of like light bulbs clicking for people? Like, what is it about teaching that you think you've drawn to?
I think that that's part of it, right? Like I said, I told my story earlier about sitting with tears in my eyes and have to go and buy SOLIDWORKS for Dummies. Like when you are, I mean, we all are running into this, you know, whatever program we are using that we have never used before. The first time we download a program and trying to figure out what the heck, what am I supposed to do here to make the program do whatever I need to do, right? And I don't care what it is, right? Like you installed Slack the first time at your company and you're looking and you're like,
right,
what the heck?
Right.
And I love, it's just satisfying to share what you know and then have somebody else be super excited because it just helped them get over that they don't have to go through the frustration of it. I think that's what I enjoy is when you just know that people get excited that they don't have to fight something that seems. I mean, so now I work for Autodesk, and now I'm kind of like part of the sausage factory, right? Like now I get to see how everything works in the background. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I joke with some of the development team about, you know, make the software as easy as Uber was, right? Mm-hmm. Like, remember the first time I installed Uber on my phone, just the concept of being able to press a button and a car would show up at your doorstep seemed crazy. And then that you didn't have to pay when you walked out. And then when you went through the experience, I remember I was so, you know, excited that it could be so easy, right? Like when I walked out on my first Uber ride, I was like, really? That worked. So sometimes I tell the developers, like, try to make software like that. Well, you know, like, that's how we got to try to approach it.
On the teaching side, so not only were you teaching in person, but you also started publishing videos to YouTube. And I just did like a reverse search on your channel. It looks like the first one was 11 years ago. It's like an airplane window in Robot Works, it looks like. So why did you start posting to YouTube? And gosh, I mean, YouTube must not have been that old, right? If for that long ago.
Yeah, I mean, when I used YouTube the first time, it was a place to put a video so I could embed it in a blog post.
Got it. Stuff. Right, okay.
So I wrote a blog post about robots. And I don't know, I can't remember exactly what the blog post is about today, but it was a blog post where there was something about robots, and I found this video of this robot polishing a airplane window, and I needed to put it somewhere. And that was YouTube. So I just posted it up to YouTube. And then, you know, I think slowly YouTube kind of like became a place where you uploaded videos as tutorials. And I remember I did that while I was still working at the SolidWorks reseller. I started kind of creating videos on how to do different things. So it was very topic specific. Right, like how do you create a 2D drawing from your 3D file or something like that. And I would sit at the kitchen table at home after work and you would just kind of like do a screen capture right on the computer screen and just no microphone, no gear, no showing your face. You were just talking kind of over it.
So it looks like, because I was kind of looking through the views and then it's almost like there was an inflection point when it's like you put out a Learn Fusion 360, the basics, and then you had a CAM one right after that about 5 years ago. Was there a point when you realized that YouTube could be its own thing?
Yeah, so I think while I was still a CAD dimension, so when I was still a SolidWorks application engineer, I started uploading SolidWorks tutorials and MasterCAM tutorials up there. But they were still with the idea of embedding them into a blog post, I think. Like it was still... Back then, it was still about getting everybody to that blog post and get them to read it. And then when I got to Autodesk, I started here about 6-7 years ago as I was actually a CAM technical marketing manager. So I was creating videos primarily for like our websites.
Okay.
To kind of show if there was anything where you showed inside the software, I would kind of create that video and do some voiceovers for that. And that was when I think I started realizing that you could start uploading just tutorials just to YouTube, and people would actually kind of like watch them and leave a comment and would find them helpful. And then I got in to do a little bit of Fusion 360 because there was also CAM inside of Fusion 360, and we started thinking. Forgetting about the blog and just starting putting putting it up on YouTube. And then the big thing, I don't know if you're ready to jump there yet, but then the big thing was when I started the live streams, that was kind of like when things, I think, at least from my, in my world, kind of started taking a little bit off on the YouTube side.
Yeah, sure. So, when did you start doing the live streams?
So I started doing it. So I started doing the live streams. What is that? That's probably about 4 years now.
Okay.
I would think, 3 or 4 years ago. And it was like, it was right when, you know, people were starting doing live streams for gaming, I think on Twitch. And then YouTube came out with this live streaming thing. And if you go and look at my Fusion live streams, I did a couple as kind of like a test just to kind of seeing what I thought of it. And I mean, the first time I did a live stream, two people showed up, right? And it was just kind of like a test to see if it worked. And it did work. And then I was wondering if live streams would be something that could become something.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really know. But then I decided that I was going to do a live stream 5 days a week. And I was going to do a minimum of 100 of them because I knew that, you know, number 14, it would get hard to come up with a topic.
Right.
And then it would be easy to just give up. So I was like, nope, that was only, I was going to do 100, and there was only two ways that I would not do 100. One would be if I was sick, and two would be if my boss here at Autodesk called me up and said, stop wasting your time. So that was my commitment. And that, I think, was what made everything, like, that was what kind of kickstarted the YouTube algorithms, because I posted every single day.
Yeah.
Like, and I didn't know, but I mean, like, the way the YouTube algorithms kind of, like, were set up, they just pushed everything up front, right? And then it kind of, like, stopped. And then I was doing some tutorials in the weekend still. So okay. I would do 5 days a week live streams, but then I would create, like, the absolute beginner videos. And I would do that like on a Saturday or something like that.
I did not realize you did 100. Like that was your goal going out. Like I definitely remember you. Anytime I got on YouTube, I feel like there would be a little live icon next to your name. Like, oh, he's doing something else fun. Did you go into those like with a specific topic? Like you said, you didn't want to run out after 14, or like did you eventually start to get questions and you was more of like response to the questions, or like a mix between the two?
It was a little bit of a mix. It's kind of funny because, you know, if I don't know today, but back then for sure, if you told somebody, hey, we got to do 100 of these in a row, people would freak out,
right?
Because, you know, oh my God, I can't come up with 100 topics. And like I said, I knew that it's easy to come up with 10, but then it starts getting hard. But it really didn't become hard because people would leave comments and say, well, how do I do this? How do I do that? And then you could just kind of take that as a topic and do something around that. And, you know, then new features came into Fusion, for example, and then you could do that. So I think that there's something I like about trying things. And sometimes you don't know if it's a good, like, this might come and bite me later, but let's try to see if we can't do it. And then if we do it, then it's a success.
So this whole time that you were doing the live streams and do the videos, you were employed by Autodesk. Is that okay? For some reason, I guess when I saw the evangelist, because I feel like you had mentioned that a few times, because that was your title, like technical evangelist. Is that you had mentioned?
So I started as a CAM technical marketing manager and did that. But then when I started doing the live streams, and I probably had done maybe 80 or 100 of them, then my boss came to me and says, we should really just make you a Fusion 360 evangelist because that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then they changed me over to become an evangelist.
So yeah, when I first saw that, I thought that it was, because I know some companies will have evangelists, quote unquote, that do what you're doing, but they're just either they're making affiliate sales or they're not like directly related. Did you ever get Or do you even now get like comments from people you're working with? Because I feel like you're the face of Fusion 360, for better or for worse. When I think of Fusion, I think of Large. And I feel like the majority of people listening to this or who are learning Fusion from my side of things would think that. But do you just get weird reactions from folks or like funny interactions with people that you work with?
Yeah, I mean, I have a couple sometimes, right? Okay. But it's also funny because, you know, it's humbling when people take the time to leave comments on videos or even like reach out on email and say thank you for it, or go to events and people come over and want to take a selfie or something. I mean, that's amazing,
yeah.
You know. But I even like my the best moment. I think for me was one time I was at a restaurant in Buffalo with my family, and somebody came over and is like, "Are you Lars?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Can we take a picture?" My wife and kids is just laughing. They think it's freaking hilarious. The best thing about this whole thing, and I love that, and I appreciate people are so kind.
Right.
When I go to Autodesk, if I go into like our office, for example, we have an office in San Francisco, nobody knows who I am.
That's funny.
But it's just hilarious, right? Like, it's very rare I'm walking down any of the offices at Autodesk and somebody is like, "Hey, are you Lars?" No, you know, because we have so many different products. So it's a very small, I got to be a very certain place at the right time to have people recognizing me. So.
All right, I want to jump into the interview with Lars real quick to let you know that this show is brought to you by Furniture Design in Fusion 360. So this is a very Fusion 360 heavy episode. Lars has incredible free resources online where you can learn Fusion. You can do an incredible job learning the complete software. But if you want a step-by-step process and walk you through the specifics, especially if you are wanting to design furniture, then I had put out a brand new course over the summer that I am pretty proud of, and a lot of people have been giving me some great feedback on, and you can learn how to not only design, but also create plans, create cut lists, even do some CNC stuff. And if you want to check out the course, then you can go to course.makeorbreakshop.com, and then you can check out Furniture Design in Fusion 360, and then you can use the promo code MOBS, so Make or Break Show, and you can save 25% off either the furniture course or the CAM and CNC course or the bundle of those two together. So let's jump back into our interview with Lars.
And that kind of leads into what I wanted to ask you about in terms of the folks that use Fusion. So I assume a lot of people that work at Autodesk, they're thinking about the pro end user, the folks that have these massive CNCs, they're doing pro end work. But then I feel like a lot of the work that you have done and maybe what you're doing now is for more of the beginner. You're just kind of getting into this world. So like, how do you see Fusion? Does it kind of straddle both of those worlds? Or do you think there's kind of a shift for it focusing more on one end or the other?
No. So, I mean, Fusion covers both and will, you know, like, the idea behind Fusion was really kind of like starting, giving an opportunity to kind of start from scratch, mm-hmm. You know, because we have other 3D modeling software like Inventors and others. And Fusion was kind of like an approach. So let's try to think a little bit different, put more things into it, right? Like it has these different workspaces. You can do all these different kinds of things in there. And the Fusion community with hobbyists and personal users has been a huge, huge part of Fusion, and I'm fairly, you know, like I'm fairly low on you know, I'm like, if you go to a restaurant, I'm the bus boy, right?
Got it.
I want to keep the plates and stuff like that. I'm definitely not, you know, one of the high decision makers, but that has really been kind of like the tone from the get go. That's important. We want to make 3D modeling and 3D machining available to everyone. So the whole community of hobbyists and personal use, that's a huge part of Fusion. But then of course there's also the professional users of it. And there's focus on that. So you know, one of the things that I've been working a lot on, and you know, I'm sure some of your listeners have come across, like things like generative design. You know, we have a product called Power Mill. It has some very advanced milling and things like that. And all these things are being also brought into Fusion. And then we just kind of, you know, there's a paying version, and then there is a hobbyist professional version. Mm-hmm. And it's for both. Both can use it. And that's not, to my knowledge, going to change anytime soon at all.
Yeah, because that's probably the question I get most when I tell people about Fusion. They're like, "How much does it cost?" I'm like, "Well, if you don't make more than $100,000 a year using it, then it's totally free." So, is the idea that eventually some of those people will like go into more professional manufacturing, and it kind of grows with them, or is it always like we want to have a free option out there just to have this access to that more hobbier side community too?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for both. Okay. I think, you know, if somebody want to tinker with some 3D CAD and get it into their 3D printer and you know, just print things to fix around the house, there you go. Go ahead and do that. If you are, you know, somebody, I've said before, like a John Grimsmo or John Saunders type of guys who start out in that garage, got a little Tormark and was wondering if they could make it into a business, yeah, then use the software until your business start, you know, being at a point where it makes sense to spend $495 for a year of Fusion 360. And then there is, you know, the bigger shop. So one of the things, and like just to understand, like on the professional level, so going back to like when I was at Ridlam, where we use SolidWorks, many places have something like SolidWorks or Inventor or some like, you know, very expensive, big CAD tools, mm-hmm. but maybe they have a little machine department. And for them to go out and spend thousands of dollars for something, you know, like a GibbsCAM or MasterCAM or something to run prototypes doesn't make much sense. Got maybe it. Their function for $495 can fit in there.
Yeah.
You know, so it's playing both fields, and that's cool. The idea.
Yeah.
We want, and yeah, I mean, it would be awesome if somebody started out just tinkering, and then they figure out that, hey, I love this, and you know, one day they have a Haas machine, and they, you know, pay $495 for Fusion, and I'm happy with that. And that would be great.
Yeah. Okay. So recently, you announced that. You, I guess we're back on YouTube, but you also were the lead of the customer success and adoption team at Fusion. So what is that? What's that look like for you? Like, kind of what's your day-to-day now like?
So I missed this last part.
Oh, sorry. What's kind of what's your day-to-day look like now? Like what's your...
Yeah. So I can just kind of, if anybody's wondering why I stopped making content. So I was a Fusion... We might as well tie the loop up. So I was a Fusion evangelist.
Sorry.
All these videos. Then I got an opportunity to go and lead the technical marketing team for our core products. So that's Inventor and Vault and other kind of high-end things. And I had to take that opportunity. I tried to make content while I was doing that. So like in the weekends, I would be creating Fusion 360 videos. But I got burned out. And it just... It blurred the lines between what is Autodesk paying to do, you know, and then there's this Fusion 360 and this community that I really liked. So I did that for, so I did a year where I tried to keep it rolling. And then I was just like, I need some weekends with the family. I need to focus on what I'm actually paid to do. So I stopped making videos. But then about a month and a half ago, I had an opportunity to come back to the Fusion world. And be part of the customer success and adoption team for Fusion 360. And this is a really amazing group of guys. These guys know Fusion better than I do. And the job is really to help users, you know, onboard and adopt and use Fusion. So that is either somebody like Brad Tallis, on the Fusion 360 YouTube channel, who does a lot of live streams there. It's working with customers you know, who bought Fusion 360. So we might come in there and help onboarding them, making sure that they get some personalized training, things like that. And then it's also, you know, helping out on the forum sometimes, just really just devoted to help users. Actually, as we are recording this now, I have my first video coming out tonight.
Oh, cool. Channel, okay.
Where I'm doing some what's new, because I kind of lost 12 months.
Yeah.
Of 360. So I'm kind of like doing a little bit of a recap of what have happened the last 12 months that somebody maybe have missed with Fusion. So yeah, so it's good to be back. I'm excited. I get to people, you know, are sending me more emails now. I get to kind of try to help people get over the hurdle and get their products done in Fusion.
Yeah, that's cool. Okay, so I definitely would talk a little more specific then on the Fusion side of things. Gosh, you've done so many tutorials. Is there a video or a topic you just love teaching people about? Like, is there just something where people are like, oh, wow, I didn't realize that was something you could do inside of the program?
I always lean towards the beginners. It's just like people many times ask me about, hey, can you do more advanced topics? And I could, but I really just like getting people over the hump, especially because I think one of the problems with learning content, and I do the same thing when I create some of my absolute beginner videos, you kind of are stuck to the same three features that you kind of are showing, right? So you're kind of, you're sketching something, you either extrude it, you add some fillets, you cut a hole through it, and that is kind of, if you can get people there, they can maybe keep rolling. But functions like lofting or revolve, but people many times kind of get stuck on those because they have maybe never been introduced to them. So I kind of like to teach the basic, but then try to throw in some of those other ones in the mix that hopefully make somebody be like, oh, wait a minute, that was the tool I was looking for.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any CNCs in your shop? Because are you in your shop right now, or is it a lot of?
Yeah, I'm on this first floor of my garage.
Okay.
So you know, being in the United States, everything is big. And I have a garage that is ridiculously big. I call it my shop, whatever you want to call it. And I built an office on the first floor. Okay. That's where I'm sitting now. I have a StepCraft 840. Well, it's not mine. I borrowed it from StepCraft. They were kind enough to lend it to me. But it's a DIY type of machine. I made some videos where I've had it in it. The biggest problem I have is finding the time to use it, right? But yeah, I have that. And then I have a Ultimaker 3D printer S5 too that they were kind enough to lend to me.
So the 3D printing piece, so you mentioned a lot has changed in the last year. I mean, that's something, the slicing and everything for 3D printing, like I didn't even realize Fusion could do that. And then I was like, oh, wait a minute, there's a whole nother tab in here. I didn't even realize. So what's that kind of been like? Because that feels like that's a whole nother world that you guys are getting into.
Yes. And I actually probably need to do some investigation there too.
Yeah.
I think learn what's in there with that. So I'm thinking about how to get into this. So we have a product at Autodesk called NetFab. That is a very high-end simulation software for metal 3D printing.
Okay.
So metal 3D printing, I mean, that has come a long way, right? But metal 3D printing, one of the problems with metal 3D printing is that it's very expensive to print parts in metal. I mean, like a simple part that we would think about printing in our standard FDM printers, you know, a little kind of like part would cost like $3,000 in metal.
Yeah.
So one of the things that they were after years ago was a way to simulate kind of like the print and making sure that you got good parts, because you couldn't, you know, like I'm not a very good 3D printer guy with an FDM standard type. And I mean, I've I have definitely made mistakes, right? I start printing something like, oh crap, this is not going to work. And then you throw it out and then you just try again. But if the parts are $3,000, then you don't throw out many parts. So there was a program called NetFat that we acquired years ago. And so that was one of the things we wanted to put into Fusion as for anybody who's doing metal 3D printing, that they could do some analysis and things like that. But the cool thing is that if you have a program like NetFab, you have the code, and now you can start looking at that and be like, well, how can we also make that available for what I call standard FDM printing? And again, for anybody listening, you guys probably know more about printing than I do. So that's why we introduced what we call FFF, a module into Fusion where you can do that. And it's definitely an area that I need to explore more too. And I know that the teams are developing more for.
And that would be replacing like Cura for Ultimaker. That's the idea. So you model it and then you have the step where you can slice it and then you can send it basically directly to the printer.
Yeah. I like Cura though.
Yeah, Cura's great. Yeah.
I actually like it a lot. But I think something similar to that. Yeah.
Gotcha.
So one of the things, and I don't know about Cura, but I mean like the latticing inside of your 3D parts, now you can suddenly start, you know, adding different type of lattice work. I don't know about other 3D printing like Cura, what you can do in those, but I think that that's part of the thought. We can add that in there.
Gotcha.
And then when you send, so right now, what I do is I save it out in an STL file and then I bring it into Cura. And then, you know, then you kind of slice the part and then you send it off. Well, when you send it off, that is NC code, just like you do into a mill.
Mm-hmm.
So having that already been inside of Fusion Manufacture Workspace, it kind of seemed to make sense. I haven't really tested it out myself yet, though. But one of the things about that, just to kind of like dive deep, I'll get a little micro down the rabbit hole. The thing about that, though, that you can now send it to via posting via Fusion is that now you can actually get into the post.
Okay.
And you can modify the posts. And that's something that we have done in the CNC world for many, many years. I mean, like back when I worked at Ritlam and I ran Mastercam, I would go in and modify the post myself, get it to do like a cooling blast, or, you know, you wanted the machine, the table to end over here when it was done with a program, you could get all that into the post. And I would imagine that you can do the same with the 3D printing module. I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I'm making this on the spot. But like that is one thing that I think would be interesting to see what people want to do with that.
So on the CNC and the CAM side of things, I think I've read it, or maybe you've mentioned it. That is basically the same software that is in Inventor. So like the pro, so you're pretty much using the same tools that even like the pro level folks are using inside of Fusion.
Yeah. Fusion actually is probably one step ahead.
Oh, really? Okay.
Inside of Inventor. So right now the development team for CAM inside of Fusion, they develop everything on the for Fusion first, and then they push it into Inventor.
Okay.
And there's actually also a module that runs inside of SolidWorks called HSMWorks that it gets pushed into too. So you know, everything is developed on the core of Fusion.
The rate that you guys are coming out with stuff is always fun to open it up and hit that little icon or that little bar at the top to see. Like the arrange function just last month inside of like the manufacturing assemblies. I was like, oh my gosh, I've been doing this like a really bootleg way for a long time and this is now super easy. It's pretty crazy what all you guys are adding in. Are there, oh no, you can't talk about it, but are there things coming up that you're excited about, or are there like just different areas or features that you think are going to be pretty neat coming up?
Yeah. I mean, so that's one of the things I would say that I feel most blessed about working at Autodesk is to kind of like I said, being in the sausage factory and see how it's made. You know, because I remember back when I was working at Ritlam out and using Mastercam, I was one of these people who would find an issue with the software, a bug, and I would report it. And then when they came out with a new version and it wasn't fixed, I was the guy who was like, come on, reported it. Why didn't you fix it? And now where I'm on the inside, and you suddenly realize that it's not that easy,
right?
Like if you have a leaky faucet, it's pretty easy to find out where the error is and then go in and fix it, replace a part, and you're done. Software is not like that at all. A lot of it, it's almost like, I think the best analogy I've ever heard is making software is like baking a cake. You know, like you take the dry ingredients, you know, you mix those together, you take the wet ingredients, you mix those together, and then you mix everything together, and then it's got to maybe sit for a little while, and then you put it in the oven. So everything kind of like builds upon one another. You can't put the cake in the oven first before you have done the other steps. And that's kind of how software works. So many times when there are certain things that maybe is not working the way you think it should, or maybe what seems like an easy fix, it's actually something that is pretty deep in somewhere. Mm. And if you try to fix that, you might break a lot of other things. So with that said, the people that is working on Fusion, developing on Fusion, I think this is one of the things that I probably need to share more outside to the community. These people are so passionate, and they're working so hard, and they care so much about what they're creating. Like, I'm so appreciative of these programmers and developers, the amount of so now I kind of get to hear some of the discussions when they're working on new things coming out, and the amount of passion that is in there, it's just amazing to see. And they're really trying to solve people's problems and do it, but they're also trying to do it the right way. Mm-hmm. So they're trying not just to put up, you know, duct tape around the leaky faucet, but actually trying to go in there and ask some questions about, like, well, why do we need it? Do we even need to do it like that? So one of the things you can do inside of Fusion, if you go up to the right side of your screen, there's a question mark up there, and you click on that, there's a couple of different drop downs, and one of them there is you can actually go in and click on a roadmap, and you can see what the development team are planning on that they're working on coming out in 2020. So for example, we just had the was it wraparound in Bosch, mm-hmm. That just came out, where you can now put text on a round face. That was in that roadmap.
Oh, cool.
Some of the things that they're working on for CAM, for example, is they're working on, you can trim your tool paths in a better way. You can also, in your preferences, so if you go up and click on your icon in the upper right, and you go into preferences, there's some preview functions in there too you can get to, and you can turn on things that they're working on that maybe is like beta, is maybe not fully in there yet, but you can go in and you can utilize some of those different things. They're working on so many interesting things they're trying to come out with. And I love it. Yeah, it's those guys are amazing.
So there's a couple questions that have come in. And if you guys have questions, just drop them in the chat. But this is Justin, I think. He is looking at the sculpting, the form environment. So he's done a lot of stuff on the modeling. And I know that's like a different shift just in how you even think about it. It's like almost like going into Maya or something. Like, how would you recommend people getting their mind around that, other than just, I guess, watching your videos? Or are there any good places you'd send them of content you've already made?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely recommend anybody to go in, maybe go out on YouTube and search there. There's a guy at Autodesk called Jamie Shear, who have done some really good content around the sculpting environment, kind of like as an intro to it. The biggest thing about the sculpting is it's like working in clay. So when we are doing standard 3D modeling inside of Fusion, we all have these sketches that we need to constrain
right.
dimension. I talked earlier about my frustration with that. But we are in a very defined area when we're doing that. Sculpting is different, right? Sculpting is about grabbing almost like a blanket that is floating weightlessly in space and start dragging on corners and pulling it. And I would say, I would tell people to go in, maybe watch a couple of videos, but then go in and play with it and then think about bringing that sculpt back into your standard design. Because that's where I think sometimes people get a little bogged down with, between sculpt and standard 3D modeling, parametric modeling, is that, okay, so they go out in the sculpt workspace, they work out there, they get their shape, but now they're like, well, what do I need to do with it? Like, how do I, and what you really probably want to do is you want to turn it into a solid. You want to turn it back into that standard 3D space. And I had made a couple of videos where I'm kind of doing both. I remember I did a coffee mug at one point where, you know, I kind of took and I did the cup itself as a standard solid, but then I used the sculpt environment to do the handle because, you know, that's kind of free-forming, and then showed how you can kind of like attach them both in the end and you end up with a solid model with that.
That's cool. Yeah, I'll definitely make sure to include that video. That's a good one. Also, this is also coming from Justin. He mentioned, is there anything you've seen over the years that's really caught your eye of things people have been able to make in Fusion? Like, are any things that stand out to you?
Go up in the gallery, there's the gallery, the Fusion, go Google Fusion 360 gallery and just look at what people are creating up there. It blows my mind. And I think it's true because, you know, like I'm lucky enough, fortunate enough that a lot of people go in and look at my videos and give me, you know, a lot of pat on the backs for that. But I'm not one of these guys who, like, there's people who sit down and spend like just hours upon hours modeling these cool things, airplanes, jewelry, all these things that I'm looking at. I'm like, man, I don't even know where I want to start. And then I think, like I think I said earlier, I'm really fascinated about the people who are tinkers, making things in their garage, playing around with Fusion, and then actually are able to do a product that they maybe are able to, even if you're just giving it Christmas gifts, but also like maybe selling on eBay or something like that. People who have the small CNC routers and are able to make things. And I think it blows my mind because when I started back, you know, when I started my apprenticeship back when I was 16 as a mold maker, I would never have thought that you could do what you can do today.
Right.
Where you can download Fusion 360 for free. You can buy a little tabletop mill or 3D printer or whatever, you know, and then you can start making things for cosplay or, you know, cutting boards or these crazy things and actually make a little side business out of it and loving doing it. Like that, I love that. I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember the first time I 3D modeled something. I think I CNC'd it. I might have 3D printed it, but then had like the real object. And I was like, I just made this. Like, there's like a thing where you're just like, oh, this is what, like, took it out of the computer and turned it into real life. That's so cool. And all the stuff you can do. You can do the whole process in Fusion, which is great. Okay. So one other question, going back to the CAM environment, how do you see it fitting with tools like Vectrex stuff or even like the super simple stuff that like Easel with Inventables? Like, are there certain use cases you think you should use Fusion or you think it can kind of fit any situation that you're looking for?
I think
or do you have to say always use Fusion because of your job?
No, that's what I was about to say. I think you should use the software that gets the job done
right.
For you. I that's one of the things that I also, again, like sometimes when I'm talking to developers and stuff like that, my team, the customer success team, we are trying to be the voice of the customers. And like I many times say, you know, Fusion is just a hammer, right? Like somebody is just trying to get something done. That's, you know, like there's a guy named Seth Godin who one time said, you know, nobody wants a quarter inch drill.
Right.
People want a hole. And actually, they don't really want a hole. They want, you know, a way to hang up a shelf so they can clean up the books they have on the floor, right? Like, and that's how I look at these different tools. Like, they're just a way to get things done. So if Fusion could do it for you, I think you should dive into it. And I love that. And I'm here to help you the best I can. But I mean, like, if you, you know, if you're using some other kind of software that gets the job done, go ahead, do that for me. I mean, like, that's whatever makes you happy.
For Cam, then, what do you think Fusion is strongest at? Or, like, what do you think it's really, really good at?
Yeah, so Fusion's CAM is based on what I would call machine shop CAM. Mm-hmm. Anything that goes, we talked about Haas's earlier, right? Like, that is the basis of the CAM inside of Fusion is standard, what we would call up to 3-axis milling. There's some 5-axis capabilities in there. There's some water jet in there. But it is kind of based for mid-level machine shop kind of thing. Now, if you want it, you can, of course, use it on, you know, your tabletop CNC mills, like my StepCraft, for example. You know, it will run that. But it is based on, and I think that's important for, especially for hobbyists, personal users, when they dive into Fusion, is just to remember that it's kind of based on mechanical CAD, mm-hmm. you know, like a SOLIDWORKS Inventor. And, you know, the CAM inside of that is based on like the machine shop type work, because that does sometimes get frustrating if you are trying to, you found some cool picture online that is pixelated and you want to bring mm-hmm. it in and you want to carve that into a cutting board on your little tabletop, it sometimes seems like you got to do a lot of steps
right.
in Fusion, and that's why.
Because I've always thought if anything ever turns 3D or there's any type of contour, like, I'm going to Fusion, because doing anything else just doesn't make any sense. So just the 3D part of it just is pretty crazy. I appreciate all the time. I know you're super busy doing all kinds of cool stuff, but thank you so much for jumping on and chatting. So for people that do want to connect with you, is YouTube, is that the primary place for you right now?
Actually, I just set up a new site, LarsChristensen.org.
If
you go there, you can find my contact information. You can email me. I'll do my best to answer any questions, anything there. Yeah, my first name, last name, .org. That's probably the best way to get to me.
Sweet. Oh, and so from the website, I saw that you had a business book section where you have different reviews and stuff. So what's the best book that you've read this year?
The best book I've read ever. I rather want to say that.
Okay.
Now, there's a book called Extreme Ownership by Jocko Willick, and that is a Navy SEAL guy who wrote a business book with his partner, Leif Babin, I think it is. That book is absolutely amazing. I just finished Leaders Eat Last by Simon Sinek. That was a great book too. Yeah, I read a lot of books.
That's awesome. Yeah, when I saw that, I was like, oh, cool. Because I love all that stuff as well. Well, thank you so much for taking the time. It was a blast chatting with you. Real cool to see and all the crazy stuff that you're doing. So it's pretty incredible.
Thank you so much for having me on, Brandon.
Totally. All right. Thanks for hanging around to the end of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in to see the updates that are going on inside of my shop. So this is where I give you guys a quick update about what has been going on. And this is pretty exciting. There are a lot of videos coming up that I'm very excited about. So one that just came out this week was all about photogrammetry, which is how you take something in the real world, you take a ton of pictures of it from all different angles, throw into the computer does some crazy computer stuff, and out pops a 3D model. So there's a lot more that goes into that, but I get into the full process on me learning how to do it. So there's a few free software out there that is incredible, as well as a few paid ones. And so we get into all those different options, and you guys can check that out over on my site or on YouTube at the Make a Break Shop. So that was the big one that came out this week.
So in the tech world, like the phone, camera, that kind of world, October is affectionately known as Techtober because there's always new things coming out. Like literally last week, I think 3 new cameras came out and I was like, ooh, do I need that in my shop? But to go into that, I've got like a Tech November about to come up. So basically I have 3 or 4 different machines that I'm going to be doing reviews on. I think there's like 2 or 3 lasers. There's a CNC. So all of those are coming very soon and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I've been working on one of the reviews, actually a really small CNC that's $250. It's actually an update to an old one that I did a review on that did pretty well. And it could be an interesting option if you're wanting to get into the CNC world, but you don't have a lot of space and you don't want to spend a lot of money. And then I'm really excited. There is a CO2 laser that is fairly cheap. It's a K40. If you guys are familiar with the laser world, then you know those are the imports from China. But a lot of people get nervous about them because of the safety and the build quality. But there basically is a new company stateside that is selling the same machines, but they're doing a lot of quality control on them. So they bring them in, they check them, and then they send them out. And I think this is going to be, might be my recommendation moving forward. If you want to get on the very low end of the CO2 lasers, that could be a super cool option. And then some more that are coming forward as well. But so yeah, so not a super ton of updates. I would love to know the things that you guys are working on. I've got some projects coming up, but I'll talk to you more about those later. But I would actually love to know the things that you are working on. So hit me up over on Instagram at the Make or Break Shop, or feel free to shoot me an email at brandon@makeorbreakshop.com. And until next time, go make or break something in your shop. All right, see you guys.